whole thing. Cadillac up here to get it. And he did go, and I was glad that he did. But I didn't go, of course, but I would like to. That was Texas' last splash. He never felt well again. He didn't live very long.
Well, then, when did you get to know Tex?
Gosh, I don't know how many years, but he moved back to Horton, down where they built the big shovel right across the road to the little old houses.
Yeah.
And I don't know why he came back, or where he came from, or where he'd been, or anything. But he built a little old, built up packing crates and odds and ends and bits and pieces of lumber, a little shanty there. I guess he came up to Clarkson Furniture Store, who was another original member of the Kentucky Bluegrass Band. Played some with them, with somebody that he knew. And they were telling me about him, and I just stopped in down there one day.
He built the shanty himself?
Yeah, he built it himself, and he had cardboard boxes stacked up to the ceiling, had his clothes and everything in them, and letters and pictures and magazines and everything you could think of just stacked in that little old place, just a little sort of a two-room lean-to. But Tex was at the end of his rope. He was just run plumb out, still drinking some. And so I got to stop him there, and I'll have to say that they told me that he was still drinking some. I never smelled anything on it. We hit it off real good and just got to be buddies. And then he'd come by here once in a while. And he just barely was making it. I knew him for a year and a half, I guess, and played some with him one place or another. And buddy, and I can't think who it was. Tape's going to be all messed up. My mind rambles.
My tape is a little rambling. Don't worry.
his brother Joe Race Frowles is a drummer from years and years, and this guy had been in the service, and he's brother. But anyway, he knew Tex was down there, and he'd come by and talk him into going down to Tennessee somewhere and playing maybe a couple weeks at a time. Tex would go, but he wouldn't stay too long. He didn't want to get back into it, really. And so he picked up a little money, and then whoever came out with the Last Cheater's Waltz, if you remember the tune.
Last Cheater's Waltz.
Okay. It was a popular country song some 12, 15 years ago, however long ago this was. And the turnaround in that song was taken from West Lady Waltz. They played a couple of phrases of the West Lady Waltz in the turnaround between the verses each time. And whoever had Texas, was Texas agent, had his licensing and everything. And they collected Texas royalties on that song. So he bought him a trailer and moved to Hartford and got an automobile, and by that time had completely quit drinking and straightened up and was just doing fine, and even found his at least one of his kids, his daughter over in Illinois, that he had no idea where she was. And she had some children. He made his grandkids, and she came to see him, and he was just great. And then I stopped by one day, and he told me he had this cancer, and he only lived in. It was his throat. He got hoarse, and he couldn't talk, and cancer was in his throat. And he went down to, where's the cancer clinic? Madisonville is the famous cancer clinic.
Kroger Clinic, probably.
Yeah. He did get back into living a little while
before. From the time you met him until he died, you saw him make quite a change.
Oh, yeah. Made a tremendous change. And I had him to judge a couple times over the fiddling contest. I got he and Sleepy Marlin together, and that's a story in itself. That was the highlights of the contest since we've been having it. You want that story?
Well, yeah. Get ready to say, tell me.
Sleepy Marlin I've known for number of years, and Sleepy lives in Clarksville, Indiana, just across the river from Louisville. It's the Marlin family band, and Sleepy has 9 children. They're all boys, and they all play music. And 7 of them, primarily, Sometimes they switch back and borrow one of the others, but formed this family band. And Sleepy was an old-time country fiddler from Texas Day in Bills back in the 30s. And after these boys were grown, they settled down around Louisville there, and they play. The Marlin Band still plays a lot of clubs. You see their name in the Courier Journal every week. But Sleepy's arthritis, so I'm prohibited from playing anymore. But anyhow, he and Tex and the Monroes were all in Chicago in 1929 and 30. And they were on different radio stations. But Sleepy and Tex had known each other, well, all of them had, since about 1930. And they had bumped together, and I think Sleepy was in a movie or two. Tex, of course, was in the worlds of movies, but they'd seen each other off and on over the years, but they had never played together. And I went up to Sleepy's one day and mentioned something about having met Tex Atchison. Well, he'd come that high out of his chair. He wanted to know where he was, thought he was dead. So he hadn't heard from him for years. So he wanted to know where he was and all about it. So the contest was coming up, and so we cooked up an idea to have Tex and Sleepy both at the contest. Well, they worried me to death. One of them called me, and then the next one to call me just to make sure the other one was coming. And we got over there, and they both showed up and greeted each other with tears in their eyes and so on. So I said, well, you guys are going to play. You both told me you never played a tune together. So we got around behind the stage, and with Jace, who's Sleepy's, one of Sleepy's sons, and Tex, and Sleepy and I, and they got those fiddles out and just run through a half a verse of San Antonio Rose, two or three tunes, and said, we're ready, and we went out on stage. So I told the crowd this story, how long they'd known each other and how long it had been since they'd seen each other. They played about 15 minutes, I guess, the four of us. They got through the crowd. Everybody in that park, 3,000 people, was on their feet. Like you said, by the feeling a while ago, it was just it just hit the whole crowd, and that you couldn't tell that they hadn't played 5,000 times. They both were that professional. They just whatever one of them think of and played tunes. I don't think they ever played what we'd run through behind the stage. They just grabbed whatever come up, said let's do this one, and away we'd go.
Huh?
Doing
the
judging? No, I don't think either one of them judged that particular year. Maybe one of them was a judge that year. But they both judged for me a number of times, but never together.
How does that work if you're a musician and you're judging for a...
Well, if you're not a musician, you don't really are not familiar enough with the music to judge it as a root.
Right, that's true. But I was just wondering, the better the musician, the better the judge. Is that all?
No, that's sometimes exactly the opposite. I said if you're not a musician, you're not qualified. That's not true. Some of the best judges that I know, one fellow over in Indiana was president of the Indiana Fiddle Association for years, named Carl Mickelson, and he's a very, very competent judge, but never played. He didn't play anything. But there are quite a few guitar pickers who are good judges of fiddle.
What makes a good judge?
Well, a good judge has to, first of all, know if the guy's playing the right tune. He has to have a good ear for tone. He also has to know where the inflections and the different things that you can put into a certain. And then he has to have to judge for me, he has to have a heck of a good sense of timing, because that's my main thought is, I'm probably wrong, but it doesn't hurt me near as bad for somebody to miss a note as it does to miss a beat.
Now, when you're saying timing, are you saying rhythm?
Rhythm.
For me. I mean, that's why.
Okay, rhythm. And meter. A lot of good musicians cannot stay within the framework. They get so much fingering in there that they come out to... off the beat. A lot of country singers anymore evidently do that on purpose, because there's darn few of them sing on the beat. But you just have to be familiar with the music. Now, what we judge in a contest is not necessarily entertainment. We're not judging the entertainment part of the thing. There should be contests for entertainment because it's two different things altogether. Mm-hmm. But we judge the technicalities, the rhythm and timing, innovation, one day I'll find you a judging slip directly and give it to you.
Well, I guess if you're talking about innovation, does that mean taking a song and putting
being able to put your own self into the song? And we also give points off for excessive
licks.
Yeah, too much. Losing track of the tune. So on. You get points off for that. Mark O'Connor, I'm sure you're familiar with. Famous Nashville fiddler now.
Mm-hmm.
Mark started in the contest circuit and won ours twice. But when he was just a little kid, he had so much ability, and still does. He can do anything in the world that comes in his mind, that fiddle just says it for him. It's his voice. And, well, I remember one year he won a mandolin contest with an old fiddle tune we called Bill. Said it was Bill Cheatham, and he played the first half of the first verse Bill Cheatham. From there on, I didn't know what he was playing. But it was in time, and his meter was right, but it wasn't, you know, he put so much into it. So he did do it well enough to win that particular contest. I don't remember who was judging. But there are points off for that. That will hurt you some time. But there are five parts to a tune. We look for five different things, and we have part. And if you, no matter how good your execution is, muffle notes and that will point off. But you can execute it perfectly. You can do three things perfectly, and then do, say, your meter gets out. Then you can lose. But the crowd never understands why this, and a lot of the musicians don't, why a particular musician wins a particular contest. Because they're just sitting there being entertained, and they're not, and I do it when I'm not judging. I let myself be entertained and don't really hear the bad notes, and you listen for everything in the tune when you judge.
So most of the audience is there for entertainment.
Right. Uh-huh. And we ride a kind of a tightrope in the contest, and I'm more familiar with this part of music than anything else because I've done it more. But we have to have the crowd in order to pay the prize money to the musicians. There's no point in getting out on stage and playing if there's nobody to listen. Well, the musicians all want you to arrange it so that it's just for them. They want to schedule it so they play when they want to play, and they want to. And you can't do that because you've got to remember that you have all these people sitting out there that bought a ticket to get in. Well, the people out on the hill, they want any dead places. They don't want to wait while the guy tunes. They don't want to give the fellow a chance to get his one guitar player's playing with a guy on the stage. He comes off the stage, he's going to play with the next one. They have to check their tuning, and they have to hit two or three licks of that tune to get the feel. And they don't, they say, why, you know, on TV, the show goes on, you don't do all that way. So you have to try to keep everything as balanced as you can between keeping the musicians happy. We got to have them, bless their hearts, they've got to entertain the crowd, and to keep the crowd happy with free entertainment, because when you think about it, there'll be maybe 100 contestants, and there'll be 20 winners, and a whole lot of people came all up. And so you don't just go say, you get out there. And you don't want to do that, but you can't do what the crowd wants exactly, and you can't do what the musicians want exactly. Back to the judging for just a minute. We have, there are different ways to do this, but we use three judges. Some people use five judges, and they'll throw away the highest score on each team and the lowest score, just as a precaution to keep anybody from jacking up his friend or from knocking down his enemy. I personally don't think that that helps a whole lot, because I think there are a lot of good judges who might judge everybody lower, but as long as he's consistent, it doesn't matter. If one guy's given the next to the best musicians there an 18 or 19 on the certain part of the tune, mm-hmm. the other guy's only giving him a 14. But if he doesn't give anybody in the contest over a 16, then he's still as accurate as ever, but his scores would be thrown out. We use three judges. It's primary economy. We don't make that much money. We try to keep the tickets low enough till everybody can come bring their family. And we can't pay the judges enough to even pay their expenses. We pay them very little, but we do try to have a room for them for a couple of nights. And if you get five judges, it costs more money, and it takes up rooms that fans or fiddlers could use when they come in, so we only use three. But I try to get a judge possibly from Alabama, maybe one from Virginia or Kentucky, and one from Illinois or Missouri, and try to shuffle them around so that they're not that familiar with each other, and so that everybody judges for himself, and so that check and balances will work, that so that if one guy's listening for one thing, another for another, well, hopefully between the three of them, that we use the total score mm-hmm. of the three judges, that that everything will balance out.
So when Tex was judging, he was with a team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's always judged with two other judges. Each person judges individually. He doesn't even add his own score. He just writes down what he considers that guy did for that part of that tune, all five parts of one tune.
Okay.
And then they hand it to the tabulator, and the tabulator's added up. And
that was my next question, because, well, if they're going to go with general consensus, each one has to be doing the same thing, given rating the same quality, right,
yeah.
of the five.
But in many cases, two judges will pick one winner and one judge pick another, but and they never come out like I would do it. If I have time to sit and listen, seldom ever do I totally agree with the judges, and I shouldn't, because it's always a matter of opinion. And it's a thing that the crowd and the musicians need to understand. As long as we have the human element, we're not ever going to be exactly accurate. We're as accurate as we can be. And even if it is, if you took it to a vote with 100 judges and they came out with that, then some people are still going to disagree, and I'd be one of those. I'd say, well, I don't care what 100 people thought. That guy played better. You know, you have that opinion.
Well, now, did you tell me that you had written some articles about Tex?
I've used some of Tex's stories in my little... Did I show you what I did around here for years with the columns?
No. I think we talked about it, but I don't remember.
I picked up just some of them here.
L. Keith Lawrence did one article on him, and I have a...
I don't write articles
papers,
as such. I do folk tapes, mm-hmm. and if... You know, anybody happens to get in one or tells me a story that I use.
There it is.
I just happened to hit a fiddle story there that tickled my fancy, and so you run through that, you know. I write about people, and I don't care who the people are or what.
Oh, all right, you've got most of this. Does this come from here, around here, or do you just...
No, it's not fiddling. That's not a fiddling book. That's just a book of people that know. I was looking if I did have something in here.
The things that you put in the paper that Tex told you, did you say where they came from? Or you
For instance, one story that I know I used, and I don't know whether it's in here or not, but Tex told me about playing somewhere in Texas, Montana. Their band was staying in this hotel, and Bob Wills' band was staying in the same hotel. They were not playing at the same place, but stayed in the same hotel. And famous violinist Heifetz had a concert in Dallas, I believe it was in Dallas, at the same time. So anyway, the two bands had been there for several days, and they'd get together when there wasn't, you know, in the afternoon or whenever they wasn't playing, or after jam and what have you, and of course a little drinking going on. And finally they got so many complaints that the hotel manager made a rule that there wouldn't be any instruments in the room. They'd have to leave their case because it made too much racket between the two bands. So Tex said there were several of them from both bands, he and some of Bob's musicians and so on, sitting around the lobby, no less, not an overcoat, but a cape and a top hat. And his valet, following him in, got out of his limousine carrying this violin case. And he walks up to the desk, and there's a young kid, 20 years old or so, behind the desk, and pick up his reservation in the valet asked for his room said, "Where are you going to fiddle?" And he said, "Young man, that is not a fiddle. That's a genuine Stradivarius violin. And I'm taking that to the room." He said, "You ain't going to take that fiddle up to your room, this young Texan." And they were all Texan, they were all listening. And he said, "Young man, you don't understand." Said, "I've told you that is not a fiddle. I wish you would not call it a fiddle. It's a genuine Stradivarius violin. And where I go, it goes. That goes to my room." And he said, "You ain't going to take that fiddle up to your room." And he said, "You don't understand." Said, "I'm Hyphits. Hyphits." And he said, "I don't give a damn if you're Bob Wills. You ain't taking that fiddle up to your room."
Yeah, I think he was upset.
Bob Wills was the greatest thing in the world. That Texan, Hyphits didn't mean anything. Mm-hmm. But that's one of Texas tales he used to tell about an old fiddler that we all, people my age, all remember, that was on the Grand Ole Opry years ahead of his time. Wilder than a March hare. But his name is Arthur Smith. Now, it was not the Arthur Smith who later became the TV star on the guitar, but his name was Arthur Smith, and he was Grand Ole Opry fiddler. And he played licks that we use in the contest today that were unheard of at that time. He was a whale of a fiddler. But he would come to California primarily to see Jimmy Wakely. He was a friend of Jimmy's. And Jimmy, he wanted to play the fiddle all the time. Of course, Jimmy, Tex said, enjoyed that, but he had other things to do. So Tex lived out there at that time when he was making movies. And when Jimmy brought her over to Tex's house and leave him for a day or two to get him out of the way. And he'd tell some of the tales about where he'd take Arthur and so on. He's just an old country man. And drank a right smart, but such things as
Tex talked. Did he talk about how he got started with it?
Yeah, he was not from Horton or Rosine. He was from McHenry. That's where he was raised. Told me even that. And he played around square dances and what have you. Sung and played fiddle when he was a kid. And it's my understanding that he knew the Monroes, and maybe they played, but they never played. They were not the same band. That's like 15 miles from Horton to McHenry, so they were in two different neighborhoods. But Tex got a chance to go to Chicago. Back in those days, all the major radio stations had a staff band. WHAS in Louisville did, and LW in Cincinnati, WSM, of course. And several stations in Chicago, Louisiana Hayride originated from a staff band on a radio station down there. And so Chicago, there were several stations, WJJD, and I forget the call letters of all of them. But Tex went to Chicago and probably got, like most of them he didn't say, but probably got a job doing something else. The Monroes, Birch and Bill and Charlie worked at a factory or something up there when they played. And so he got a job on one of the radio stations and organized a little band. And Sleepy Martin was playing on another radio station. And Bill and Birch and Charlie were playing on, and a little later, I think Tex went in 28 and Bill in 29, if I remember correctly. They all played on opposing radio stations, but they all knew each other at that time. So from there, he just got to playing, one thing led to another. Oh, by the way, the sports announcer on this radio station where Tex worked in Chicago. Reagan.
Isn't that something? Reagan.
And so he went on then to California, and I don't know how he managed, but he did get into, he told me he was in 34 episodes of the Durango Kid, the Charles Starrett movies that we used to see on Saturday afternoon. He also made five or six of the television episodes of Wagon Train with Ward Bond. But primarily he would be like Roy Rogers, or made a lot of Tex Ritter movies. But they always had music, in those movies, and they'd be standing around the corral playing, and Tex was, he did act, and he had more of a part than most of the band did in some of the movies, but his prime reason for being there was as a left-handed fiddler. before Tex died, actually moved the trailer down to Hartford, I stopped by there one day and said, I want to show you something. He went and got a letter. And it was, I remember if this was when Reagan was running for president or whether he had already acted for the first time. But he went and got the letter. I read off, Dear Tex, I'm so happy to find out where you are. He said he met somebody, and I believe Jimmy Wakefield, and said he told me that, said I didn't know you were still alive, and he wrote about three pages, and it was signed Ron, and the return address was Ronald Reagan.
Good.
All the magazines and literature and fan letters and stuff that he had disappeared when Tex died. We don't know where they went. Hopefully that the daughter got it. I don't know the daughter, but surely she got it and kept it.
Who was his daughter?
I don't know. She see, his wife, they he lost her back way back in the process somewhere in all the drinking days.
Mm-hmm.
And daughter lives over in Illinois somewhere, and she has children.
Well, now there's a person in the Rosine area.
Oh, somebody down there knows.
Well, now James Leach is supposed to be his cousin.
Tony Leach was Tex's nephew, and Tony's, well, Tex's sister lived in Rosine, and she married a Leach.
Maybe these are her children.
Yeah, these
James
people
Leach.
You're talking about probably, but they probably know where,
mm-hmm.
You know, where you turn down from Ousley's store there and go down to the little music, to the fire department.
Yes.
And then turn right, I believe, right after the fire department, about the first house there on the left was Tex's sister. She still is there.
Hmm. Well, I know now Lily, which I think might be this woman.
I can't remember how I went to get there.
Well, you go to the fire department.
Yeah.
And then you just keep on past the park, and then you turn the railroad track, and as soon as you cross the railroad, there's a house.
Well, that's in the right area. But I'm sure she knows, you know, where the daughter is. I just never did meet them. But I hope they did get it. I just never had her. But they was, he had pictures. He got hurt. I don't know whether he had a wreck or whether he got hurt on the movie set or what, but he was in the hospital. Had this newspaper article and had his picture sitting up in the hospital bed with mail just falling off on the floor and baskets and boxes of letters and hundreds of it. I don't remember how many, maybe thousands of fan letters people had written to him when he got hurt. So all the way to the top, and he fell all the way to the bottom, and he started going again.
Did he ever play any other instrument?
He monkeyed around. He could pick guitar fairly good, played everything upside down. He didn't retune a fiddle. He played my fiddle, or anybody's fiddle. He played it just crossed over and played it the other way. And he'd pick up the guitar if I played mandolin or something and do well on rhythm. But somewhere along the line, before he died, he got a hold of an old five-string banjo, and he never played a banjo. And you ought to see him trying to get around that thumb screw that's on the wrong side. But he could pick it pretty daggone good upside down and working around that. He picked Praline. He didn't do bluegrass. He picked the old Praline banjo, but yeah. It has some of the office fits trying to get around that thumb screw thing was in his way on the bottom side.
Did you all play?
Don't fiddle.
Oh, you don't?
No.
Nothing at all?
Well, I fiddle at home, but I don't fiddle in public because I play sour. I play mandolin, harmonica, rhythm guitar, bass, few other things, but never fiddle in public.
Oh, okay. Do you do the others?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm not smart as him. I've got to do stroke myself playing the fiddle because it sounds so pitiful. Love
is that
it,
by your standard or someone else's standard?
Well, it's by anybody's standard to hear me
you
fiddle.
You seem to have high standards, so I thought maybe you were just hard on yourself.
By anybody's standards.
Well, how did you get so involved with all this fiddling?
Well, fiddle's what I always wanted to do, but I just didn't have the ability. If I had... When I was young, I learned three chords on the guitar, and I thought that's all I ever needed. And wasn't anybody else using any more than that anyway. And mm-hmm. I wasted. I didn't really get interested in playing music until I was 45, 50 years old, other than just thumping. And if I had really set my head to it and had been somewhere where the opportunity was, I might. And I may yet. I still work on it, but I don't play it better.
Well, then you and Tex, then, when you play?
I usually played rhythm. If Tex and I just played, which we did quite a lot, he'd hear an officer down his house, I'd either would swap out, I'd pick Manly and he'd play trading tunes and dreaming up old tunes and whatever. He'd play guitar, or I'd play guitar while he played fiddle.
Well, when you all would jam together, would it help you think of older tunes that you hadn't played, or did you all, what did you all do?
Well, you just, jam session just kind of grows. We just got back to Chattanooga last weekend. We have an annual little get-together down there. It was a contest. Usually I'm either judging or managing or something and talk to anybody and do very little playing. So we have several friends around Chattanooga that play, and Chuck Reeves from over Birmingham is a fine fiddler. Kid that came in this time from up East Tennessee plays guitar, and three couples from Chattanooga. So we go down there in February, and the ones that was out of town get motel together. We had three rooms in a row, so we got in the middle room, and they had three or four places for us to play and lined up that we could play if we wanted to, in a mall and two or three other places. We never leave the room except to go eat, and we eat and we pick for about 3 days, and then we come home. But nobody knows, there's no leader, no formality or anything. Just when you think something, well, you kick it off and everybody plays.
Now, so that's just the general scenario, because everything I've been to, it seems that way. It seems like you just go and kind of
spot. It just happens. Sometimes it's a good one, sometimes it's not. But you never had any problem with Tex, because he knew hundreds of tunes, and one thing reminded him of that. Sometimes he wouldn't play, sometimes he'd want to talk, and sometimes he wanted to play, and if he wanted to play, he'd play until you had to get up and say, Tex, I got to go home.
Well, if he talked, did he reminisce mainly?
Yeah, he'd start a tale, and he'd tell you three more, and then he'd get back to the one he started. I can't, of course, remember a lot of them, but he talked a lot about, for instance, I thought of a tune one day that I figured he probably knew, and it's called Bonnie Lass. It came from Scotland by way of Canada, as near as I can tell, and it's really an old bagpipe tune, and pretty good old fiddle tune, and played in the key of C, which a lot of the most of the old breakdowns were played in C, the ones that play in D and A now. But I happened to strike that tune, and that reminded Tex of Bonaparte's Retreat, which is also a Scottish bagpipe tune that was handed down, and Pee Wee King and Red Stewart wrote words and put to it, but it's an old Scottish tune. And so he said he fiddled down, he said they were on set, and he and another fiddler, I forget who it was, he told me, but I didn't know, making a movie somewhere on in Hollywood or around California. And somebody else on another lot was making a movie, and they had a bunch of Scottish bagpipers from Scotland who they brought over just to make this movie. Didn't have anything to do with what Tex and the other guy was doing. And he said he and this other guy was on break, they weren't doing anything at a particular time. They were sitting in their trailer, little dressing room trailer, and got to swapping tunes on the fiddle, and one of them played Bonaparte's Retreat. Looked up and said two or three of these bagpipers had walked over, heard that tune. So they got playing it together, and he said they had to come and get them to go back on the set. They got to play an old Scottish tunes on the bagpipes and the fiddle. But a lot of fiddle music, well, most of it originated with our ancestors, Scotland or England or Ireland or somewhere over there, and a whole lot of it was Scottish.
Have you talked to the guy from Berea who's collecting all these old fiddle tunes?
I'm not a collector. I don't have a lot of tapes or anything like that. I'm not really a student of it. I just love it and always did. My uncles all played when I was a kid, and my first memories are people coming in and rode in the front room, set the furniture out in the other room, and break out the fiddles and have square dance, just without the invitation or anything.
Well, I'm going to turn this over and get that finished. remember from when I interviewed you before that we had, you have a real music tradition behind you.
And I eventually got into working on instruments, and I fiddle bows and patch fiddles. Oh, yeah. I got about half a dozen fiddles, a couple of basses. But it's just a part of a heritage that I've always liked. And fiddle is my favorite instrument. I just never could play the blooming thing.
Well, where do your clients come from? Local people?
Oh, yeah, mostly local people. I don't do that as a business or anything to make money. I just do it for a hobby.
Are there many fiddlers around here?
A few. Bud Meredith I've played with off and on for 40, 45 years. Bud's a good old-time fiddler. He lives here in the county. Bobby, who has a fiddle shop down just a side on. Yeah, you know where it is.
I've seen him in the
Herman, the family lives right down the street here. He's from Grayson County. Lonnie Pierce comes by pretty often. Lonnie had the Bluegrass Alliance, which was a real popular bluegrass band a few years ago, and some near hits. And they played the road for a good while. Lonnie was born and raised here.
There are enough musical people here that I...
Well, you might like to talk to Bud. Now, Bud has 1,000 old fiddle tunes, and he has tunes that nobody plays anymore. And
that's
if you're interested in that sort of thing,
yes,
why?
Yes. One thing they're trying, we're trying to
get. Yeah, Bud never kind of pick his mind anymore to get them, but he can play all day without ever playing the same tune twice. And he got a lot of those from a couple of old fiddlers here that I don't remember because I've not always been in Grayson County. I didn't come here. I played with Bud before I ever much more knew where Litchfield was, but Bud played it around E-Town where we had a band up there. And but there was Grayson County's full of Higdons, and there was an old fiddler here that they called Great Ace Higdon, who I never heard of, and I don't guess he ever recorded the tune. But Bud and Lonnie both got a lot of tunes from Great Ace, and then there was another fellow here. His name slipped my mind. But anyway, a lot of the tunes were this one particular fiddler, and I did hear him play at one time. He used to live when I came here. And in fact, Bud and Lonnie and I went up one time and played, tried to get him to play. He wanted to hear them fiddle, and we went up and I took the guitar and we stayed with him for hours, but he never would fiddle. He wanted them to play this.
Well,
but they got a lot of them from that.
Maybe we should work on that at some point.
Yeah, I'd be glad to introduce you to Bud.
Okay.
It's amazing. A tune that Bud got from this fellow I was talking about, the old fiddler here, that I got from one of my uncles, and they never knew each other, I'm sure. But the tune's called Little D, and just little letter D.
Mm-hmm.
It's played in D. But anyway, it's a very similar tune to a tune that they call New Liberty, or most people now just call it Liberty. But the older fiddlers call it New Liberty because there was an old rag called Liberty that nobody plays anymore, and New Liberty is a breakdown. But this Little D is a very similar tune to Liberty. But Bud and I both heard it. Bud's older than I am, and he got it from Worthel Bocock, is who I'm trying to say was the fiddler. And I got it from Uncle Joe Martin. But we're the only two people I know of that ever play the thing, and every time either one of us start to play it, if there's anybody else playing with us, the first change they make, they go to G on the guitar because that's where Liberty goes, but this one doesn't. It goes to A. And so they think we don't know how to play Liberty. But what happened, I think, was, and I would almost bet on it because there are hundreds of tunes that have a phrase or something in them that sound like another tune. And maybe if you change areas, Clark Kessinger's music, he has one called that he called Rat Cheese Under the Hill up in East Kentucky. And that same, practically the same tune has 15 different names in different parts of the country. But maybe the course will be different or something. So what I think they did, the guy would go over in the next valley to a square dance over there somewhere, and he would hear this fiddler that he hadn't heard play, play a tune. Well, it had run through his head, but by the time he got home, he'd forgotten half of it. But he remembers enough just to get the tune laid down, and then he makes up something to go with it. So then it becomes known as something else over here, and the tune is different because the guy just simply didn't remember how to play it when he came back, because nothing was written down. And I think that's why a lot of those tunes confuse themselves that way.
Do you think the railroad influenced the music around here much?
People moving has always influenced music, because you play what you hear, at least so-called folk music. I don't know if it's this thing, but
American music.
Okay.
That's what I
mean. You're influenced by what you're exposed to. And used to be that we could, even when we first started these contests, we could pretty well identify traditional Missouri fiddling. We could identify Appalachian. We could identify Southern Tennessee and Alabama fiddling, which was different from Kentucky fiddling.
Mm-hmm.
And then Indiana and Ohio, Illinois, they're good fiddlers up there, but they play a little different style than Missouri or us. And then along come Texas. And from that time on, the thing just melted down, and it did exactly what's happened to bluegrass. And bluegrass is not as much interest anymore to older people. Now let me qualify that. Bluegrass is going stronger than it ever had, and it had to do what it's done. But it has left behind a lot of us older people, because we stuck to the tradition and to the clipping time and the foot patting music without all the notes. And this is what happened to fiddling. Texas fiddlers is all notes. Appalachian, Kentucky fiddling is mostly longbow. It's more bow work than it is notes. And we played here the basic tune much smoother, much easier to dance to, much cleaner.
Mm-hmm.
But then the Texas, with all the their violin notes, all the they put 100 notes where the Appalachian fiddler puts 10.
My goodness.
And you know, you're just fingering all the time, which is what Uptown Bluegrass does. You just flip all over that thing.
Yes,
and so the music has evolved. Now what did that was getting together at the contest or whatever, but you said railroad. Back in the early days, the railroad was a major means of transportation. And that's the reason that the music changed, because people began to go places that they hadn't been before, and a lot of them took their fiddles with them, and they would play. Well, these guys, wherever they went, would pick up not exactly what they played, but hear something, and they put it into their music, and it all melded together. So it did definitely everything, any kind of movement, even if it was walking from one valley to the next, influenced the music.
Well, did people around here go from community to community playing this music like they did on down? Amazing to me at the movement these people have had by the railroad.
Not, now, this right here is not my country. I'm a little further up the creek. But my country and my time was the Depression era. I was born in 1929. And there wasn't that much travel, because there wasn't any means to get any place except to walk, so the distance wasn't that great. But now, 15-20 miles was not out of the way. Then, after we got on up closer to World War II, people began to come over. Clayton McMichigan would come down in our country and play football, and got that done. And then, of course, radio by that time had come along.
That was a big influence.
Radio, of course, put the same tunes available to everybody that radio. And even the tunes that we learned from that were different, because you would hear enough of it just to get the basic tune, and you'd run off and play it and add something of your own to it.
Do you think radio helped to take away the regional styles?
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
more than, or did they just keep adopting them? You know, did it? That's what I'm trying to say. How do you weigh what happened?
When we judge a fiddling contest, we say, because it started off that way, old time fiddle contest. It isn't. It's no kin to the old time fiddle. What we wind up judging, the guy that gets the prize, is not any more related to old time fiddle than jazz is to blues. Well, I even further than that, because they are very closely related, jazz and blues are, but then bluegrass to pop. But what happens, and there's nothing you can do about it, and you don't really want to, but music evolves. Music is a universal language. It doesn't, you can, anybody can understand. You talk about your Russians who came over, they love bluegrass. They understand what the music's saying. They don't give a whack what the words are saying.
That's very true.
So music is a language spoken by everyone as a natural thing, but it has to evolve. Now, when we say old-time music and we try to judge that, I immediately go back to what I heard my uncles play when I was 7 or 8 years old. And I can, those tunes run through my head, and I didn't want to go to bed. They'd make us go to bed early, you know, but I loved it. And the fiddle could just make my hair stand up. But that's old-time music to me. Okay, if a guy's 10 years younger than I am, by that time radio had come around. Mac Mitchin was traveling around to different places. There were quite a few contests at that time that some people who had a little money, we didn't get to, but some people had a little money went to. And they heard Natchez the Indian, and they heard Clayton Mac Mitchin, and they heard Arthur Smith and all these different plays. And so the music changed. So this guy who is judging here to the side of me that's 10 years younger, his old-time music is not the same thing as my old-time music. Okay, then if I get with Bud Meredith, who's 10 years older than I am, then Bud heard Gray Nace Higdon play, and I didn't. But he remembers a different old-time music than I did. Okay, we say, well, this is not old-time music. How do we know? We have no way of knowing how much those tunes changed from the time that they left, our ancestors left Scotland, until we started having the first record that we have is in the 1926-27,
mm-hmm.
and very few of those. Mm-hmm. Well, how much had the music already changed before it got to where we know what we say is the authentic old-time music is not any more authentic than what we're saying?
It's true, and I'm sure it changed a lot.
Well, I know it did. It had to, because it changed so much since.
Do you think then the main, before radio, then the main influences for change around here would be the was there any river tracks around here of any?
Well, the county that I lived in and this county, all joined counties that were on the river. And of course the river was the first mode of transportation in Kentucky.
But you know, they did a lot of fiddle playing on those rafts.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what that kind of thing went on around.
In our particular country, music was a release. It was not a means of making a living. Nobody that I knew made a living at. It was just a way to blow off a little steam, and you didn't have any money to do anything else. You didn't have any other entertainment, and you just, it was just a, it's like, well, I don't know what to say, but pressure valve. It tided people through the hardest of times. Because in all the histories and the accounts that you read of the Old West, the settlers and everything, there was always a dance and there was always a fitting somewhere involved. It music has just been with us, and it's just, like people jump up and down, take a vacation and go thousands of miles to ski down the Rocky Mountains or whatever they do. That's a release. That lets the pressure off of what you do every day. And that's what music was. We couldn't go 100 miles, and we couldn't go see a show because we didn't have money enough to get in it. There wasn't anything else to do, so music was a release. And any travel, be it river, be it railroad, or be it whatever, had influence on music simply because you heard other people play. That's my opinion.
I just wondered,
I don't think
around here, how many people came in off the railroad with instruments or music?
That I couldn't tell you because I live 20 miles from a railroad and I never saw three trains until I was grown.
Mm-hmm. In your experience, it wasn't a factor?
No, it wasn't a factor. And neither was the river because I never saw the Ohio River until I was grown either, and I didn't live 30 by Al Smith.
Well, your main influences were family and friends who played.
Right.
Right.
And
then later the radio also.
Now, several people in my mother's immediate family played. Mm-hmm. If they really wanted to get settled and advertise a square dance, I mean by advertising, just tell everybody it's going to have a few days ahead of time and let the word get around, they would get probably my Uncle Joe Martin and his wife and Artie to play guitar. And then there'd be another one or two that would come and go. My dad played. Artie's brother's wife played piano. Backhanded rhythm piano, not the tune, but we used piano if there ever was one, if we could get where there was piano, and she played chords on the piano. But if we really wanted to have a good square dance, they'd go to Big Springs, which was about 10 miles across the country and about 30, 40 miles by road, but they'd go back through the woods and take an extra mule and get an old colored fellow named Gabe Dow. And he had a bass fiddle, and that's the only one I ever saw until I was half grown. But he would ride that mule and bring it bass fiddle. He was real bow-legged, and I can remember him standing there. He'd stand like that, like a bench, and you could see daylight between his knees on both sides of that bass fiddle, and he played with a bow. And if they really wanted to have a downtown dance, well, they'd bring him Gabe and his bass fiddle.
Today is March the 3rd, 1992. I'm in the office. Strange.
Sorry about that.
Oh, I don't mind. The tape recorder quit working for a minute. I'm just going to put the date on here. It's working again. Scared to turn it off now. It did that once before, and I had it cleaned. Maybe it needs cleaning again.
An old Sony about like that, the first static and what have you, and it's dragging a little bit. Never could get anybody to work on the thing.
They don't have a commission.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that when it's grand.
Yeah, I loved the one I had. I've had 4 or 5 since, and I didn't think near that much of it, but it finally got to where it wouldn't work, and you can't hardly get anybody to fix anything like that anymore.
Well, I'm going to come back because I need to get back home before.
It's been so long since we talked, and I haven't really helped you much because.
Well, you helped me more than you think. I listened to the interview coming up that we talked about.
I don't remember what we talked about.
Well, we talked a little bit just about fiddling, and then you said a few things, so that was good. And I am interested in finding.
Yeah.
There's a real important reason.
There's just an awful lot of country and old time music heritage in this part of the country. And I don't know all of it by any means. Now, another thing, I'd give anything if you could have interviewed Tex about, for instance, the Merle Travis style guitar picking. Now, somewhere, and I have to, what is it? I might have that laying right back here. Some names that Tex gave me.
Mm.
Yeah. Now, Tex went back one step further than most people that I remember on that style of picking. But he said he played, of course, with Merle Travis. He knew Merle well. They were friends.
So he really did play with Merle.
Oh, yeah.
And I knew that it was
him. Okay, then Mose Rager, who Merle always gave credit for that style of guitar picking, was... Merle picked it up from him, the style, and then, of course, he added Merle Travis to it. He changed it considerably. By the way, I missed a jam session by one day one time. There was an old fiddler, Cherokee Indian fiddler named Shorty Sheehan that played on the opera years ago, and Shorty's wife was a jazz guitar picker, and Shorty was an old-time fiddler, but anyway, they had a ball wherever they went. But she was wild on that jazz guitar playing on Gibson flat top. And
what was her name?
Her name is Juanita Sheehan. Shorty's dead now. Juanita, the last I heard, still lives in Napa. She married a fellow from the Philippines, and I don't know if they're still married or not. I can't tell you his name. But I went to Nashville to the Grand Masters, and At that time, the old, was the Andrew Jackson Hotel, it was next down by the old opera house, and everybody had stayed there the night before, and Mose Rager was still living. And I got out of the car, they had the eliminations at the old opera house, this has been 15 years ago, and first couple I run into was Shorty and Juanita. I played with them a lot at contests, and she said, "Oh, I looked for you all night." Said, "We got up in the room," it's the first time she'd ever met Mose Rager. And they got in one of the hotel rooms up there, and she said, "We played all night long, her and Mose Rager," and I missed it. If I'd have just been there, I'd have been right in the middle of it.
Well, you could play.
Arnold Schultz is a name that you hear.
Yes, I've been working on
that. Who Mose gave credit for a lot of his guitar picking.
I've interviewed Mr. Schultz's nephew.
Okay, now do you know who Walter Taylor is?
Yes, because Schultz played with him in a band.
Okay. Well,
there.
Texas is the one that brought up Walter Taylor to me, and that was a new one.
I think Walter Taylor is dead now.
Walter Taylor was colored, if I remember.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Now let's see, was that Walter Taylor that was colored? Yeah, he was.
And Tex said that he played with Walter Taylor before he played with Arnold Schultz and Mose Rager.
Because Walter Taylor and Arnold Schultz's uncle.
So I'm thinking I may have Schultz and Taylor Hindhart before, but one of the other of them was probably the first or the first one that's known that used that that style of guitar pick.
I imagine it.
The galloping style.
Yes. Now let's see, Walt Taylor. I can't remember. It may be that Walt and Arnold were the same age. Other black guys that were kin to Arnold.
Well, the style of picking is all I know.
I know, but I mean, did he say anything about the?
Well, no, he didn't. I don't recall that he made any particular comment. Of course, when you say Merle Travis, well, you know, you Chet and even Les Paul to a great extent. And most guitar pickers came through that stage to get where they are. But Merle picked it up from Mose, and Mose evidently got it from Walter Taylor and or Arnold Schultz.
Now, in this interview I have that was done with Mose Rager, he learned what he knew from Kennedy Jones. All muddy water. Everybody says something different, but this is what Rager said.
Well, all I've got, I knew none of these people. You know, what I picked up here and there.
This is before he got sick. Now, Arnold Schultz was his people were slaves.
Uh-huh.
That's where his people were, and it's controversial. Some people say he was raised in Prentice, but Arnold Schultz's nephew says that they were raised at the Taylor
Mountain. Well, Tex was of the opinion, I don't know, he didn't tell me how he was,
right.
But he was of the opinion that Walter Taylor is the one that told Arnold Schultz how to play that kind of guitar. But now, I don't know if that's, I have no idea whether that's something he just dreamed up or
whatever. Well, that is very well could be. Maybe Walt Taylor got him started, but you know, Arnold Schultz was a hobo. I didn't realize how much of a hobo he was until I got to do it. It wasn't uncommon for him to get on a river steamboat, go to St. Louis, or Cincinnati, or go to New York, and they all say nobody could play like he could, and nobody had going on what he had going on. And when you start thinking about music.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that's true, and I'm sure that he probably played a lot of stuff, that even if he did learn it from Walter Taylor, that Walter didn't play. Like I said about the music growing.
And see, when he was a certain age, he was a hobo. But then older, he stepped more close to Rosine. Not Rosine. The last 12 years of his life, he was pretty much.
But the 9-pound hammer type of picking, to my knowledge, is all that Arnold did. Well, Merle did all kinds. A lot of the Les Paul stuff that was almost Merle was not galloping guitar. It was something else. But Merle could do it all. And each one of these people had their own style as well as the style that they learned from somebody else. And they didn't duplicate it, I'm sure, because musicians are worse than old maids. They're contrary as much people in the world, and they will not play a tune. Most of the good ones will not play just exactly like somebody else because they're themselves, they're individuals.
On this interview that Keith Lawrence at the paper did, there Boots Fought was one of the main. At that time, Miss Ella was in the rest home, and Keith gave me that have talked so much, Miss Ella didn't have enough chance to really talk. I mean, what they said was important, but, you know, it would have been so much nicer if they had let her talk more. Well, maybe her mind really wasn't that good. But interesting to me about all the stuff, because now, on this interview with Mo Fragger, I have a total of an hour interview there.
Yeah.
And then I heard today that Mr. Monroe played in Tense with Arnold Schultz. Sometimes Mr. Monroe would discount Arnold Schultz in interviews, and at other times Mr. Monroe will say he was a big influence. So I figured that's because it wasn't popular to say a black person was influential at some point.
I don't know.
You think that would be part of it?
I know the first time I ever saw Bill Monroe was in a tent. They carried a tent. You know who Clyde Moody was?
Yes, he was a preacher, wasn't he?
No.
No?
That's
right.
Clyde Moody was a lead singer, and Clyde, I can almost tell you a song or two that he did after he left Bill Monroe. He went on in country music.
He was with
But when I was a kid, back in before the war, back in 38 or 39, we managed to get to E-Town, which was some 20 miles away, maybe twice a year. Usually Santa Claus Day when they throwed out the candy kisses, and Christmas Eve to get the orange and the hard candy that we got for Christmas and every toys. But for some reason, my dad got carried away, maybe got lucky, poker game or something, and he took us to E-Town to see the Bill Monroe Show. And this was before bluegrass as such. String Bean was the banjo figure. If you're familiar, okay, well, that's the kind of banjo Bill Monroe used at that time. And he played good old-time car-driving music. Mm-hmm. But Clyde Moody was the lead singer. And Chubby Wise was the fiddler, mm-hmm. one of the original bluegrass fiddler. He carried on over into when Reno and Scruggs hit the scene, while Chubby went on into the what's now true bluegrass. But we went to E-Town, and they had this tent set up. And I'm sure we wasn't there at the time, but I'm sure they played a baseball game before they did the show. That was their format. They would go to a town and set up the tent, play the local team game of baseball. That was one of Bill's requirements. They had to play baseball, play music for him, I understand, at that time. But I sat down in James's office one day, waiting while James was doing something else when we were involved in the monument for Ms. Monroe, for Bill's, James's mother, for Bill's wife. And I did, by the way, I don't know if I told you, at Spring Hill Cemetery. Now, Clyde came in, and I had seen him that one time, and I'd seen him at the opera a few times, but I'd never met the man. But anyway, he came in and just loping and sat down. And this was like 3 or 4 years ago. And we got to talking, and he got to talking about those days. I told him, and he told me who the bass player was, and I've forgotten it again. I could kick myself, but I remembered all of them at him. But he said that he and Bill Monroe had pushed that old Pontiac, I believe he said, 5,000 miles. They never had enough money to get enough gas to get from one town to the next, and they'd load that tent up. And both of them were, at that time, were great big men, over 200 pounds, stout as mule. And they would start to the next town. He said, half time he'd run out of gas, and String Bean or somebody, String couldn't drive, I guess Chubby would have to guide the car, and the rest of them get out and push it to the next town. He said, we pushed that thing 5,000 miles.
How big was
that tent?
You remember?
Oh, it was big. To us then, it was a big tent. It probably seated 50 or 75 people, terrible crowd. You know? And they'd
so when you all went, just if you can, just give me an idea of what they did.
Well, the bass player did a few comedy routines, a few little things with Bill, a straight man. Bill's got a keen sense of humor. You don't see it much, but you can see it in his eyes, and that's about the only place you can see it. And he doesn't mind comedy at all, but he never did do a comedy show. But primarily, they just got out and sung the best daggone music and played the best music that you could play. Chubby Wise has always been one of my favorite fiddlers, no matter whether he's playing bluegrass or what he's playing. Mm-hmm. He's a fine, fine musician.
I think that Stephen Gephardt has done a...
Clyde is dead now, but he was an excellent musician, and I'm trying to think of a...
Yeah, how long did the show last?
Oh, I don't know, probably an hour, 15 minutes.
Didn't they just take the tent down? I mean,
they tent down, load it up in a little old trailer they had hitched that pony at, and they'd tie up to the next town. But they'd, a lot of times would do a matinee and an evening show, but in between they'd play a baseball game, maybe not nine innings, but they'd take on anybody that wanted to play baseball with them, usually.
Did they charge admission to the ball
game? To the show? Oh, well, no, I don't know about the ball game. Never seen one of those. We didn't get there in time. But I've heard a lot of people say that they did see them play ball. I don't suppose they charge admission to that.
Hmm.
I don't know. It probably cost a dime to get in to see the music show.
You know, that's kind of interesting because everybody talks to Mr. Monroe's eye.
Yeah, I guess it did that time.
That's kind of a contradiction.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me ask you about something else that intrigues me. Have you ever heard the story about Uncle Tim dying? There are two stories that are circulating, and they're extreme. One is, it is quite a contrast.
Yes, it is.
And I haven't made total sense.
No, the only thing that I know about Uncle Penn's death was, is that Bill said that he wasn't here, and he didn't know it, and indicated, and I'm sure would have been here had he known it. But they buried Uncle Penn, and he before he knew it.
Mm-hmm.
And he was probably... Well, that was 1930, wasn't it?
Yes, around in there, 30.
Yeah, so I guess Bill was in Chicago, and communication was slow, and they just mm-hmm. wouldn't let him know. I don't recall ever hearing him say anything about that.
That's
now,
circumstance.
Really, all I've ever heard him say about Uncle Penn was that he was a good fiddler. He'll tell you that he was a good fiddler. And there are several tunes that Bill plays that he gives Uncle Penn credit for. For instance, the... Kiss Me Waltz, which I've played all my life too, but that was an Uncle Penn fiddle tune.
Now, does that mean Uncle Penn made it up himself?
No. When you give credit to somebody for a tune, it's
right.
A tune that you heard that man play.
That's where you heard it from.
Yeah, I don't know that he ever, I wouldn't say that he didn't.
We really don't know.
And probably he modified tunes like all the fiddlers did at that time. But Bill said, and Boyce Taylor, who was postmaster, and Rosine, used to talk about it quite a bit. And Bill, there was a big family of them, and Uncle Penn lived by himself in the old cabin up there above Rosine. And Bill played guitar at that time. This may not be exactly accurate. Mm-hmm. You'd need to ask Bill about this, but the both of them have told me that he and Uncle Penn played a lot of square dances, but he was crippled. And he rode a mule, and Bill walked. And they'd go round over the country and play, just the two of them a lot of times and play.
Well, you know, sure.
But he lived with Uncle Penn.
Right.
And
oh, wow.
He had that advantage of getting in on his music because he stayed there, and so he played more with him than Birch and the other boys, I would assume.
Yes, and then some of the boys didn't play at all, I don't think.
Oh, yeah, most of them
kind
did.
Kind of a divided thing. You either, if you played, you know, it seemed like there
was... All that I know that played was Birch and Charlie and Bill.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think, too. And... Another interesting
thing. That part I don't know if I've
ever
heard Bill talk
about. Behind was Clarence Wilson's daughter. Mm-hmm. And
this was when Bill was a small boy.
Right. Well, Flossie and Bill are the same age. They mm-hmm. went to school together.
But he didn't, he evidently went back home before he left because he didn't, he was, I don't know, I'm thinking 10, 11 years old when he stayed with Uncle Penn.
Right. And I'm not sure how long he stayed with Uncle Penn. I mean, he boarded the family, and I know he was with the...
I'm not even sure that it was in that little house up there that Uncle Penn eventually wound
probably
up with.
Probably wasn't, because I know I can show you three places Uncle Penn lived in a cabin.
But Bill will never put Uncle Penn down for anything.
Oh, yeah.
He's
made him immortal. I mean, he's immortalized.
Oh, yeah. And that's strange that I never knew that until... somebody came in here one day to buy a monument to go to Hattieville, and his name was Vanderbilt. Bill Monroe has said, I haven't talked to him, he's cousin to Bill, and he saw with the instruments hanging around his home and I was interested in music, and he said, Bill said that if he could find Uncle Penn's grave, that he'd like to put him up in mine. And that's the first time that I knew Uncle Penn was a person. I thought it was a song.
Well, you see, that's what I was going to ask you about, because you...
Never lived, you know.
Well, maybe if I should go over that way, maybe someone would have a connection. But, you know, we really don't know what happened to Uncle Penn's daughter. We're assuming she died. But we really don't
well,
know.
Well, whoever that guy was buying the stone core was not a Vanderbilt. It was somebody else. So I can't think. If I knew who he bought the stone core, I'd have
and
a record.
We really don't know where Penn's wife's buried either. Now, there's
no, I don't
there are all these rumors that she died the same day he died. You know, and
well, if
another
she did,
rumor,
either they didn't live together.
Oh, well, no.
Yeah.
If supposedly she was in Grayson County and he was here. I mean, there are all kinds of things circulating around.
Mr. Morris. Sure, he didn't die a month or two ago. Oh, but somebody told me that old man died.
Hmm.
He always, his wife was real sick. He moved to Litchfield off the farm. And the farm was the heavens of the bill. And he'd come down to Carolyn's restaurant up here and pick up her lunch. He never left home very much. He stayed right there with her, but he'd call and order something for them to eat, and then he'd come down and pick it up, and I'd see him in there.
Remember his first name?
Can't think of it now. But he was a regular tender in there until she died,
yeah.
And then he'd come down and eat sometimes, and I'd talk to him. And I don't recall seeing the paper or anything, but somebody told me that he died about a month ago. So that was gone too.
Well, now the other, last fall, when I was back to the Monroe house one day, they were redoing, and he was a Monroe, Louisville. He was from Rosine, but he went to Louisville and was a disc jockey on a radio station for a while. It is that all of that was a land grant at one time to the Monroes, which I think...
I'll be very little help on that because all
okay.
I've got is just picked up in conversation and just from memory.
Yep. and it's another thing, you know, Mr.
Rachel. Rachel Morris.
Rachel Morris. That's an unusual name. Okay.
V-E-A-C-H-E-L.
D-E-A.
Or something on that order.
Okay. Another thing I've noticed, too, a lot of things that Mr. Monroe has said, he's a real shy. One thing to listen to what he says, and it's another thing to see it. That's been kind of interesting, too.
Now, also, I didn't know about Cecil, but that's the kind of guy that Bill Monroe honestly is. I don't think, or at least I see Bill Monroe. A lot of people don't see through the, but Uncle Penn had a son. Now, how close they was, I've never heard him connected with music or anything. Cecil, and if you'll notice, there's a nice little monument right there beside him for
yeah,
Cecil.
Right.
And Bill would not put that monument up unless he put a Cecil monument, because he hadn't had one too. Now, Cecil was not, evidently not there. Maybe he went with his mother, and he was not there when Bill lived there, and I don't know how much contact he ever had.
He died young.
He died young.
When he was in his late teens or early 20s with pneumonia.
But anyway, Bill knew that he was there by Uncle Penn, and he put up it's not a shortchange, it's a nice monument.
Right.
For Cecil.
But it's interesting to know, wonder what in the world ever happened to his daughter.
We all hear all the stories about Bill and all the different. But I honestly can say that in what contact I've had with him, if they've done business with him, if they misunderstand him, if they just, I have no criticism for my dealings with the Monroes.
Of course, I've only met him once, and it was very pleasant, and I'm looking forward to it.
He had me and Leo Mudd one time, went down there to come down and go pop something with him, and we was both covered up. Leo's state police detective, we fiddled around there and didn't take him up. Why in the world we both didn't take a vacation go, I don't know. Missed the golden opportunity.
Well, I'm going to stop for now. This tape recorder keeps going in and out.
Found this the other day, and I only have half of it, but that's all I ever had. But I don't know if you've ever read that or not. But if you would, while you're copying things, that's one of the best articles about the old days with Bill. That and it was in Bluegrass Unlimited way back some years ago.
What's your address here?
1017 Brandenburg Road is business address.
Litchfield,
Kentucky.
Zip.
42754.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. I'm proud of every year of it. I'm 61.
What's your birthday?
November 6, 1929.
Where were you born?
I was born in Hardin County, almost in Breckenridge. Well, you have to start telling what you're close to. I was born at Arch, which is close to Vertrees, which is a route out of Cecilia, which is 6 miles from E-Town. I was about 20 miles from E-Town on the Breckenridge County line. Rough Creek.
Rough Creek.
Head of Rough Creek.
What's your ethnic background?
Baptist and Democrats, is that what you're talking about?
No, but that's good. That answers the next one. Are you Scotch, Irish, English?
Don't have any idea. My grandfather Hall was an orphan and raised by another family. We don't know who we can do on that side. And the Martin family, which was my mother's family, were probably English, but that came the route through Virginia and settled in Kentucky. But I'm mixed breed, mongrel.
What was your mother's maiden name?
Martin.
And how many children did your mom and dad have?
Five.
What are their names?
Staley.
S-T-A.
L-E-Y.
Okay.
Aline, A-L-E-N-E. Bernie. And me, Jody, J-O-D-I-E. Now, don't put no Y on that.
Okay.
And Reedy, R-E-E-D-Y.
What was your father's name?
R-E-E-D-Y.
R-E.
One D.
R-E-D-E-E.
No, R-E-E-D-Y.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Father's name?
Ed or D-E.
And mother's first name?
Lena.
What did they do for a living?
My dad was a trader. He farmed way back early when I was born, but he in the real estate business, various and sundry enterprises, swapped cattle, and always had a farm, but more trading than farming.
Well, what all did he trade, like cattle?
Anything, jewelry, guns, rings, automobiles, tractors. We'd get a crop half out and come home, wouldn't be no tractor machinery there. By the time the weeds got over the corn, well, there'd be maybe two or three tractors there.
My goodness,
he'd trade anything. Traded cattle, horses.
Now, when he was trading jewelry and things like that, was he traveling and trading, or were people coming to him?
He just rambled around from here to yonder selling real estate, and he always had a trunk full of something to swap on.
That would have been an interesting man to meet.
I trade fiddles primarily, but I knew nothing else. But it was an education fool him. He knew exactly, he'd make his mind up what he'd give for something. If he got $5 of it, he'd walk off and never think of it anymore. And he knew what he would take. I can't do that. I can't go to auction and say, well, I get carried away. I don't know when to quit. If they're raising it 50 cents at a time, it gets...
Yes, that's true.
But he did. He knew where to stop.
And let's see, what's your wife's name?
Nancy. Sing, S-E-N-G. It's not Chinese, that's German.
Is she from here?
She's from E-Town.
How many children do y'all have?
Three.
Yeah.
Carolyn, C-A-R-O-L-Y-N.
Okay.
Sharon.
All right.
And Steve.
Do they live around here, or do they live there?
Carolyn and Sharon both live in Nashville. They're both single and have a house right across the street from each other. And Steve is in college up at UK in his last year.
You grew up here?
No, I grew up.
In this area?
Well, yeah.
I have to say in this area. When you were growing up, when did you start getting involved with these musical instruments?
When I was born, my uncles always played the fiddle. And my earliest memories are old Philco radio, that's in one of those articles that I wrote, but Grand Ole Opry and Bill Monroe, and people coming in any time of the week. It happened to rain by 3 o'clock some afternoon. Well, that night there'd be 40, 50 people gathering in, roll up the old straw rug on our living room floor, and throw a square dance. I've heard music all my life.
Well, that's Well, when your uncles were here playing, did they know the Monroes and Uncle Penn and
nope.
all those people?
Uh-uh.
They were
nope.
in their own...
They knew of them, of course, and played a lot of Monroe tunes. But we were two counties away. See, we were in Hardin County, and that was in Ohio County. Bill wasn't even there then. This, I was born in 29. He left in 29 or 30. But we heard him on the radio. We were personally acquainted with Clayton McMitchin, whose monument I showed you there a while ago. He played in Louisville and around in that area in the later years on up until after World War II. But he recorded some of the earliest fiddle recordings, one of the best known fiddlers that ever was. And he would come to our part of the country and sometimes come hunting, sometimes come fiddling. But we did know him, and that was the only famous person we knew.
When did you become acquainted with the Monroes?
I met Bill first in connection with the Uncle Penn monument. I don't exactly know when I first met Birch, but Birch was sort of the promotion man. He'd come ahead of the festivals and so on. And I met Birch here in Litchfield probably at some time point or another. Now, I'd seen Bill. The first time I ever saw him, I was about 1940. 41, saw a show in the old ballpark in E-Town. We were 20 miles away. We got to town on Santa Claus Day and Christmas Eve, but my dad took us to see Bill Monroe, which was a great occasion. Clyde Moody, guitar, Chubby Wise on the fiddle, Bill, and believe it or not, String Bean on the banjo. That's before the bluegrass banjo, the three-finger style, was developed. And bass player was Cedric Rainwater. Now, I can't remember anything that ever amounts to anything, but I can see those guys standing there with them big flare-legged boot pants and high-top boots and their wide-brimmed Stetson hats, dressed up like $1 million. Thought I was in heaven.
Would that concert last all day?
No, it was a show that night. Yeah, just that night, I can't remember how long it lasted, but anyway, we'd all heard that on the radio, and it was really something to get to see them. Back in those days, now I didn't see the ball game, I'm sure they had one, but Bill, they had to work for Bill, you had to have two qualifications. You had to be able to play music Bill's way, and you had to play baseball, and they would travel from town to town, load up their... A lot of times the tent that they put up, it was maybe they play in the schoolhouse, but pulled that on the trailer behind the old Hudson automobile, and they'd hit town and take on the local team in a baseball game at afternoon, and they'd play a show that night, and then they'd load her up and head for the next town.
So you remember them with this stuff?
Yeah, although I never seen them play ball. I didn't. We didn't get there until time for the show that time.
But here they would be playing ball.
Yeah, I never saw this. But I knew at the time that they did.
That was their routine.
Right. And then Clyde Moody, I was sitting in James's office 3-4 years ago. And an old fella sitting there that I didn't recognize. And we got to talking, and it was Clyde Moody who had played with Bill many, many years. And James was into something else. Anyway, we had 30-45 minutes to sit there and talk, and he got to reminiscing about these things. And he was a big man. Bill was always big and stout, and Clyde was as big as Bill was then. Now he weighs 125 pounds. But he said he bet they'd push that old Hudson automobile 5,000 miles. They'd run out of gas, and they'd push the car, him and Bill push the car and the tent and all to the next town. Clyde would be a good man for you to... I'm not sure he's still living. He may have died in the last couple of years, but he's full of tales and memories.
So how often did they come around here?
Oh, not often then. They had, by that time, they were on the Opry, and they went first to Chicago, Charlie and Bill. And then by that time, of course, Charlie and Bill weren't playing together, and Bill was on the Opry. But there was a show here and there, but at that point, we didn't have I was raised a lot like Bill. We didn't have any money and couldn't afford those things very often. You just didn't go. What entertainment there was around home, and nobody came to that part of the country because there wasn't any place to play. So I didn't see that much of them, but we kept track of all the musicians at the time on the radio, WJJD in Chicago and the Grand Ole Opry.
So when you got ready to do this monument, you already had a good background into the roles.
Some.
It's not like it was a stranger.
Oh, no. I've been kin to that music all my life. But I did not know Bill, and I met Birch, and Birch introduced me to Bill, and I had already drawn a rough sketch of the design and showed it to Bill, and he liked it. Some 3-4 months I didn't hear from him, and then one day morning the phone rung. It was Bill, and he said, "How long will it take you to get to Nashville?" And I, off the top of my head, said 2 hours, and it takes every minute of that. And he said, "Well, I'm going to buy that monument. Meet me at Shoney's on Dixon Pike." I had no more idea where Dixon Pike was than the man in the moon, but I loaded up and took off. And I got there, and a few minutes Bill came in. We sat back and we fine drank coffee and worked out the details. And then I finished the design. He, of course, had some ideas and some things he wanted to put in. That's the only monument. I'll tell you something about the type of fellow I think Bill Monroe is. I've designed monuments for 30 years. We have many, many monuments for even famous people or all kinds of people. And most of the monuments that I do are different and unusual. That's our thing. We do specialty work. And you never find our company name on a monument because we don't feel like that it's right to advertise on something as personal as a memorial in the cemetery. And the only monument that my name appears on is Uncle Penn's, and I did that because Bill was gentleman enough to know how important that was to me, and he said, "Why don't you put your name on it?" I said, "Bill, I never have," and he said, "Put your name on the back. If you look down in the lower left-hand corner on the back, it says designed by Jody Hall," and that's the only monument that I've ever done, and I've never asked anybody to let me do that, but he volunteered to do that for me.
Did you know things about Uncle Penn?
No, actually I didn't know that Uncle Penn was really a fella. I knew the song Uncle Penn that Bill had done, played it all my life, but I did not know who he was or that his name was Vandiver or anything, and by accident, by selling a Vandiver, a monument, in another cemetery down there who was a distant relative, he told me that Bill had said that if he could find this Uncle Penn was his relative too, that he would like to purchase a monument for Uncle Penn if he could locate his grave. So I started thinking about it and drawing and trying to locate the grave. Then I met Miss Jeannie and several of the Monroes there, and Birch didn't, none of them knew exactly where it was. And so that's how I got, and then I started looking for Bill. And about the time I got ready to look for Bill, he got elected to the Hall of Fame, and it was a line of people 100 yards long wherever Bill was waiting to talk to him. It was pretty difficult to get to him. But thanks to Birch, I was able to talk to him.
So you had the idea and presented it to Mr. Monroe?
Yes.
First?
Mm-hmm.
And what did you have sketched out? Did you have the house and the...
Very close to what we have in there. Of course, it was just a pencil sketch. But when I showed it to Bill, he said, "I know what I want, I just don't know, you know, when or where I'm going to get it." And so I showed him that design, and he looked it over, and it was very close to what he had in mind. He said, that's the way I'm thinking, something with the Uncle Penn song and so on. So if you'll notice, we had to take a little artistic license. The way the monument sets, the west is in the wrong direction, but we put the town in the... symbolic of Rosine in the little cabin you see up on the hill, which you can't quite see from Rosine, but it is on the hill above Rosine. It's still there. And the sunset, and then the fiddle, of course, is everything revolves around the fiddle. And then the verse that's on there is from what Bill wrote about Uncle Penn late in the evening about sundown high on the hill above the town. Uncle Penn played the fiddle, how it would ring. You could hear it talk, you could hear it sing.
So you actually took the words from the song.
From the song.
In your mind,
yes.
This is the way you visualize it for the stone.
It's really, what I do is to put a person's ideas into, memorialize an idea. That's Bill Monroe's design. That's built around Bill's song about Bill's uncle, and it's Bill's monument.
Well, when you showed him the preliminary sketch, what did you have on it?
I had very close to what I have right there. But we were, thankfully, we were thinking along the same lines.
Yes. Well, I was wondering, too, I found this intriguing, how the fiddle is at the top, and I liked the way it comes on down.
We had that, the fiddle was done by a sculptor, and we did the lettering, which we have the facilities to do, but cutting the actual monument, they cut the monument square, the fiddle was outlined on there, and then we had a sculptor to, with a chisel to take the fiddle off. It was done.
Was that a local man?
No, it was done in Elberton, Georgia. The fiddle was.
Did you know the man?
No. I knew his by reputation.
Mm-hmm. And what was his name?
The sculptor, I'm not sure. He worked for one of the granite companies in Elberton. It was not the same place that we bought the granite, but anyway, we sent it to Elberton and had the fiddle cut on it, and then back to Elizabethtown where the lettering was finished. And then, of course, working with Bill all the way, after we got everything on it, we rubbed with onion skin paper and carbon paper and rubbed everything off and took it back to Bill to see that everything was satisfactory.
And did he like it, or did you?
Yes, he liked it very much. He made mention of it a number of times on the Opry and on different interviews. There's a picture like you have there hanging in the Bill's Museum in Nashville, and there's also one in his office, and which I'm extremely proud of.
Oh.
No, we were at this the Bean Blossom Festival, which is the daddy of all festivals, and Bill is a busy, busy man, and we didn't talk for just a few minutes, but I left him a copy of the drawing, and then came home and refined it and sent him other copies, and then, as I say, several months later, he called, and we worked it out from there.
Yeah, from the time that you all agreed to the monument, he gave you the final say-so from the onion skin paper, and how much longer was it until you all actually put it in the cemetery?
Well, I can't remember the exact dates on this, but the festival, after we got started on it, they came up with this 200th anniversary in Rosine, which was whatever that date was on the thing there, in 1973. And I would think probably along in June. So we were working on it, you know, early that spring.
Yes.
But we decided to unveil the monument at that time because the festival was being set up and Bill was going to be there. So we just added the unveiling of the monument to the festivities.
Well, on the day of the celebration and unveiling the monument, did Mr. Monroe make any comment about Uncle Penn publicly?
Oh, yes. Yes, he always gives Uncle Penn credit for his background in music. Evidently, there were several of the Monroe kids, as you well know, and Uncle Penn was Bill's mother's brother, and I don't know what had happened to his wife, whether they had separated or whether she was died or what, but Uncle Penn was crippled. He didn't walk very well. In fact, I think he used crutches, at least a cane. And he lived by himself in this little place above Rosine, and he made not able to do heavy work and farming and so on. He made his living basically playing the fiddle for dances and play parties and the things that we did back then. And Bill started out at 10, 11 years old, I understand, playing the guitar for Uncle Penn. So eventually he just moved in with him, and he lived with Uncle Penn almost until the time that he left to go to Chicago to go into music professionally.
So it was and, a period of time.
Yeah. And now not all the kids did. Just Bill lived in Uncle Penn, so they rode this mule, doubled on a mule, or Bill would walk and ride to dances around over the country. And Bill, of course, we don't have any recordings. It'd be nice if we did. But he said he was a very accomplished fiddler and played well and had a lot of tunes that that nobody else, you know, that had just gone from existence except the ones that Bill remembers. I have the same problem with the tunes that my uncles and so on play. We didn't have any tape recorders, and there are dozens of tunes that I did know that I don't know now. Every now and then I think of a little sketch of one, but he gives Uncle Penn credit for being a fine man. He raised Bill and treated him like a son, and for being an excellent musician.
So in other words, if you don't play the music without the tape recorders and things that we have now, you could lose a lot of it.
Just memory.
It was just repetition.
Mm-hmm. The music that, as you know, I'm involved in the Old Time Fiddlers Contest, old time music, which is different from bluegrass, which we're not going to attempt to explain the difference again. But it is very much different. But the music that we judge at these contests and call old time is not any more akin to the music that was played when I was in 1932 and 3 and 4 when I was a kid than rock and roll is to bluegrass. It's the same tunes. But also the music that we played then, most of it was old Scottish and Irish and English tunes that was brought over and came through the mountains and so on, handed down from father to son. And since very, very few folk or old-time musicians could read music, or read neither for that matter, it was brought in their heads. And it was handed, you know, one tune learned from another fella and so on. So probably the music we played in the 30s wasn't any kin to the music that was played in 1875, because it had already been three or four fiddlers, and everybody adds to and takes from. When you really get serious about bluegrass or old time or any other type of hand-me-down folk music, you'll find many, many tunes that are similar, very, very similar. One will remind you of another. And I think what happens, and I've been guilty of the same thing, you just in your mind will be running just a line of a melody, and you don't remember the rest of it. So you put something with it, but you have the time and the beat and the measure already set and the meter, so you come up with a tune that's very similar to another tune, which was similar to another tune, which goes on back into eternity. But the music grows and progresses and evolves, I guess is the word, and as bluegrass has, and old-time music even more than that. Now the majority of the fiddlers that win our contest read music like a college graduate reads the primer. They have studied violin, they know how to hold it, they know how to use their bow, and they mix it, but they go back and they pick up these tunes that are played by ear, but they mix so much violin in it that it's not related to the music that really is old time. Does that make any sense? But it has to, everything has to evolve. We can't stay static. And I've heard Bill say this, that somebody asked him about the what we call uptown bluegrass. I'm still a traditionalist in my string music and in bluegrass, but the Marco Connors and the Sam Bushes and the various people, the Bella Flex, they do something based on bluegrass that is so far out that it's not related very much to what Bill Monroe does, but it keeps progressing to the, what we call uptown bluegrass until it, you know, is into an entirely different thing. But Bill doesn't, at least publicly, object to that, because he understands that he made this music and that it can't stay exactly that way.
Well, with his background of watching how it evolved, evolves, it
right.
changes him.
Mm-hmm.
You have to know that.
Bill's music evolved considerably. As I said, when I first saw him, String Bean was when he wanted to be, he was a comedian. Name was Aikman. But when he wanted to be, he was an excellent clawhammer banjo picker. And that's the kind of banjo Bill was using at that time. Then when Don Reno and Scruggs came along with the three-finger North Carolina style, it fit right into what he was doing. And the music made it evolve some at that time. He experimented with different instruments, with dobros and various other instruments in the band. And before settling eventually on the five instruments that he always uses. And pure bluegrass has three-finger banjo, those five instruments, an entirely different style of playing the fiddle. And if you listen to his music, I don't know how many bluegrass boys there's been. I don't know if Bill knows, but there's been hundreds, I'd say, over the years. But you have to listen close and be fairly much of an expert to tell which fiddler is on that particular record and which singer, because Bill, everybody works for him, plays what, you know, he is definitely the band leader. His music is pure. Hard driving, best timing of anybody that I know.
Well, you know, I noticed on that picture that Stoy Gary has of Uncle Ken and his fiddle, the bow.
I saw the picture that he had, yeah.
The bow seemed so long, and I said the story, of course, I don't have enough background to know if that would be common or not, but if it is longer, why would it be longer?
I don't know. I didn't notice it being
could have been an optical illusion.
A bow, a full-size fiddle bow, is about 29 inches, 29 and a half.
It's almost
3 feet. Two and a half. And I never saw one any longer than that. But they'll vary an inch or so. But somewhere around the 30th, with the frog and everything, around 30th. I don't know. I didn't notice that on the picture.
But I just wondered if maybe it had a different sound if it were longer. Could you incorporate more sound with less movement?
Well,
I really don't know how to say it.
There is a style of old-time music that we call longbow. And what we mean by longbow is that you use all the bow going and coming. And there is another style which is somewhat used in bluegrass, although Baker, for instance, can longbow, but where you actually don't need but 4 inches of bow. And they just use the bow back and forth in a short stroke. But the longbow fiddler will maybe be doing that, but he's working from one end of the bow to the other. And the bow is designed so that it reaches comfortably. You're about at the end of it when your arm reaches back comfortably here.
I think I should follow you around some after you're talking about these things and we listen and watch. Mm-hmm.
The bow was originally like a bow and arrow. It bowed up this way.
Mm-hmm.
And back, now don't quote me too close on these dates, but somewhere around 1800, there was a Frenchman named Torte, T-O-U-R-T-E, who developed the system of how to put the tension in a bow that'll hold the hair to right tension and bow the bow the other way. And he turned out to be one of the most famous bow makers. A genuine Torte bow now is worth a word of money. But he had other bow makers who worked for him, and but he's credited with turning the bow down this way. And so since that time, the bow has been pretty standard in length and fairly standard in weight and balance and so on.
And now I'm going to turn this tape over to Sandy.
Oh, okay. Penn, they probably never got 15 miles from home to play. Very, very seldom, if they did. And we didn't. The people who came to square dance and the musicians that came, occasionally somebody would, if they really wanted to have a rip snorter, they would go to Big Springs, which was about 7 miles across the country, but I don't know how far around the road, there wasn't any way to get there. There is now, there's a road through there. But they would ride a mule across the country through High Plains and pick up an old colored fellow named Gabe Dow. And I can remember him, he had a bass fiddle, and he was the only one in that part of the country. And he was bow-legged. He couldn't head a hog to save his life. And I can remember him standing behind that bass fiddle, and you could see daylight by his knees on both sides of it, and he played with a bow. And if they really wanted to have a good dance, they would ride over there and get Gabe and his bass fiddle and take a horse or a mule for him to ride back and bring him in to play. But that was like 10 miles, you know. But he was clear out of our country. We didn't even know anybody at Big Springs because there wasn't any road across there. So the music was fairly restricted at that time until along comes radio. Then everybody who was interested in that kind of music would listen to the radio. And this, again, this is where music evolved quite a bit. You would hear a tune two or three times, hear somebody play it like Arthur Smith at the Grand Ole Opry, and then you'd try to put it together, and you couldn't play it like Arthur Smith, so you'd put in what you could do, and it'd come out similar, but an entirely different style of fiddling. So this went on in the South. Texas, we have Texas style, we have Missouri fiddling, we have Southern, Georgia and Alabama. Appalachian is entirely different thing. The Virginia boys hardly ever come over to our contest. They don't play our kind of music. They play beautiful music, but it's a different style. Okay, that's in 19th and 20th of July. And mm-hmm. Then you have the Canadian fiddlers, and New England and Canadians all go pretty well together. But now it's all melding together. Because we go to Texas to contest, the Texas boys come to Nashville, they come to our contest, we get people from Oklahoma, Colorado, Canada, and everywhere, and we're all picking up each other's licks, and it's all blended together.
So one of the differences is then, since we have mass media, and we have better transportation, it's not as individualized. Is that what you're
right.
saying?
Right. And we have tapes. And every time a fiddler goes to a contest and he hears somebody he likes, buys his tape, he comes home, he learns what he does. So the music is sounding more and more alike. Perfection, getting a lot closer to perfection, but sounding more and more like each other.
I was going to ask you, do you think that's good, or do you think we were better off when we weren't quite so close?
I hate the idea that we've lost the old shuffle longbow fiddle. And most of my cohorts and people involved in this thing at this time are either younger than I am or didn't pay any attention to it when they were younger, and they have no appreciation, we'll say. I won't say that. They know the contest fiddling much better than I. But when somebody plays a fiddle that made my hair stand up when I was a kid, they walk off because they're not putting all these violinist notes in it. And I hate it that we're losing that, but I see that we can't help losing that.
Sure, it's part of what we've given up with technology. But yesterday, a man said to me that as far as he had heard, Uncle Penn wasn't, and I'm not particularly meaning to pick on Uncle Penn, it's just that you're talking about it. And he said, well, from everything he heard, Uncle Penn was just a plain old country player, and he wasn't really all that unique. It's just that they hadn't been out, and there was a local group of people, and he was well respected in that area.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I found that a little hard to believe. I mean, it looks like, and the reason I said this, I don't have your background and I don't have your ear, but there's a lady in Owensboro that has a tape of Mose Rager.
Mm-hmm.
She interviewed him shortly before he died, and he got his instrument out and played it. My goodness, I never heard anything flow like what he did. There was nothing, and this was a cheap tape recorder, a cheap tape.
Mm-hmm.
He was an old man.
Yeah.
And it still flowed. It had this magical quality to it. And so I'm sitting here saying to myself, how do they know that Uncle Penn didn't do the same thing and had that magical quality?
Mm-hmm. you're calling it magical quality, it's an indescribable feeling.
And it seems chill.
And you cannot describe it to anybody who doesn't feel it. And I can watch you listen to music, and I know if you feel it.
How can you not feel it?
Well,
I'm not an instrument player. I'm not very good at it.
One of the best known fiddle judges in the country today privately will admit that he doesn't hear the beat in music. He plays with him, rhythm like a mule pulls a plow. He plays just behind the fiddler. The fiddler has to go before he goes. And when you feel it, you know where he's going, and you're there when he gets there. And I'm not saying that's a fault, but he doesn't feel the rhythm. Consequently, all he hears is the scratching and the overtones. And my favorite fiddling uncle, I don't know how this comes about. I can't describe this either. But the fiddler has a touch on an instrument. Anybody does. Bill has a touch on the mandolin that will never be duplicated. Even though there are people who can put as many notes and possibly more than Bill ever cared to put into it. But he has a drive that it's just there. And my uncle played the fiddle, and it scratched like running your fingers over a screen door to an extent. But he played my fiddle, it scratched. He could play anybody's fiddle, and it was just the way that he touched the fiddle. And J.T. Perkins is one of the most influential. A lot of people who play his stuff that don't even know who J.T. Perkins is, but he's Mayrab, Alabama. And there's very few of us that have been around music 20 years that can't recognize the third note that J.T. hits, because just the way he touches that instrument, never studied a music note in his life, he doesn't read anything, but there are more runs and licks and overtones used in recordings in Nashville that are J.T. Perkins' invention than you can shake a stick at, and half of them don't know why they're doing it. But Uncle Penn probably was just an average old country fiddler to most people. But Bill saw a quality.
Or maybe Bill had more quality than Uncle Penn, but it was the technique,
mm-hmm.
and then putting it with Bill's special touch. But Uncle Penn could have had a special touch.
That's right.
We really
That's right. Mose Rager had that touch. He had exactly what I'm saying.
It was amazing. I sat there, and the lady debated a long time as to whether she'd even let me listen to the tape or not. Mm-hmm. And I told her when we were finished, I said, I really appreciate you letting me do this, because I've never heard anything like that. It sent something through me. It was
I wish, and you've probably heard this name too, but I wish that you could have talked to Tex Atchison.
I visited his tombstone. I've been to his cemetery.
Tex turned out to be a real close friend after he came back here. I had heard his music. He was one of the original Prairie Ramblers, and I was a fan of theirs back years ago. Never thought I'd ever meet the man. But Tex also had the touch, and he did not play that much better than a lot of other people. In fact, Tex would never have won a contest at one of these contests. Neither would Clayton McMichen, neither would Uncle Penn, and Birch was no way close to it. Birch had a quality in his fiddling, and Birch was taken more as just, you know, he was just there. But Birch had this old-time thing that I remember when I was a little boy that we've lost, that they didn't hear anymore. And he played nothing fancy. He played straight Arkansas Traveler. Is written with so daggone many notes that I don't see how anybody could read them. But the old-time fiddlers played about every third note, and they went through the tune, but it made the feeling of the timing and the making your hair stand up and your feet wanting to pat, and Birch could do that. But Tex was that way, but Tex had more stories than any human alive, and interesting little quirks and things.
For the purposes of my oral history study, I'm very interested in him. I've listed him on my
text. told one story that I wrote in the paper, and I've used it a lot when I do the programs or after dinner things and what have you. But he had a sense of humor that's also like mine, I guess, come from the same end of the country. He left here a year before Bill did. They knew each other before they left, but he went to Chicago before Bill. But it doesn't matter. This is beside the point, though. It's probably not going to be of any value to you.
But remember, now, I'm not a historian, and I'm not a journalist. I'm an
but I like the humorous thing.
Sure.
And Tex said that the Prairie Ramblers were playing in Dallas. And if you are familiar with music at all, you know who Bob Wills is and was. Bob Wills was the cock of the walk. He was the king of music in the West. There was nobody in the world that didn't know who Bob Wills was, and there's nobody that, and Bob Wills was the sorriest musician there was, couldn't keep time to bush a basket, but he knew music, and like Pee Wee King, he knew who to hire, and he had some real good musicians. And anyway, they were both big bands, the big band era in Western and swing. And at the same time they were playing in Dallas with the Prairie Ramblers, Bob Wills' group came in. They were playing in another club in Dallas, and they all stayed in the same hotel and all knew each other. And there was so much jamming and carousing going on that the manager of the hotel put a restriction on them, and they had to check their instruments at the desk every time they'd come in, because they're keeping everybody in the hotel awake. Them two bands got together and just having a ball. And Tex said about the second day, they maybe had a two-week engagement, and there's three or four or five members of both bands sitting around the lobby for like something better to do, couldn't play, wouldn't let them have their instruments. And there was a young kid, about 17 or 18, working the desk. And in comes a limousine out front, chauffeur, valet, and this fella gets out with a top hat and a cape and a fiddle case and walks up to the desk. And he said, "I'm Heifetz, and I want to pick up my reservation." I can't think of his first name, but the world-famous violinist. And he was going to play in Dallas. And so this kid was signed him up there. And he said, "Where are you going with that fiddle?" He said, "Young man, that is not a fiddle. That's a genuine Stradivarius violin, and I'm taking it up to my room." And he said, "You can't take that fiddle up to your room." And so the violinist said, "Now, I've told you that is not a fiddle. It's a genuine Stradivarius violin. It's worth $150,000, and I'm taking it up to my room." He said, "You ain't going to take that fiddle up to your room." He said, "Young man, you don't seem to understand." He said, "I'm Heifetz, Heifetz." And he said, "I don't give a damn if you're Bob Wills. You ain't taking that fiddle up to your room." Didn't mean anything to him, but Bob Wills ruled the world. But that kind of thing, Tex just had a million of.
Well, then you said that Tex left about the same time Bill did.
Yeah, he left. Tex was Mac Henry.
Did they play together?
No. I don't think they ever played together.
They were going to a smaller, in a different part of the county?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that would be basically the reason?
To my knowledge, they never played together. Sleepy Martin lives in Clarksville, Indiana. And Sleepy was in Chicago playing on one of the radio stations. And Tex went to Chicago and got a job on a radio station. And later, Bill and Charlie came to Chicago and got a job at one of those or one of the other stations. But the station where Tex worked, the sports announcer was a young man named Ronald Regan. And Tex had a letter before he died, and no telling what happened to it. But when Regan was running for president, he showed me the letter and said, "Dear Tex," said, "I just found out from Jimmy Wakely or somebody that you were still alive." He said, "I haven't seen you in so many years," and reminisced about the days in Chicago and about the times in Hollywood and so on. And a two-page handwritten letter that he got from Ronald Regan. But anyway, Sleepy and Tex knew each other in 1929. And Sleepy went on and wound up with a family band. His family still plays in Louisville. He had nine kids, seven of them, all of them musicians, seven of them professional. And but he was played all over the West and everywhere. And so did Tex, made movies on television, on Wagon Train, and this, that, and the other. But they never played the tune together. And after this contest started, Tex moved back here, and I found out that he knew Sleepy or one through one or the other. So I invited them both down one year, and they liked to worry me to death. One or the other of them called me every 3 days to make sure the other one was coming. And so I got them together over at the contest, and Sleepy brought Jace, one of his boys, played guitar, and I played bass, and them two fiddles, and we had another one or two that we picked up and walked around behind the stage, and just hit the first two measures of three or four songs, San Antonio Rose and two or three. They got them. Tex was left-handed. And after they got through hugging each other and speaking to each other, hadn't seen them for so long, and walked out on the stage, and I told the crowd about where they started and how long we'd known each other and had never played a tune. And they broke out on that thing, and everybody in that up that hillside, 3,000 people on their feet.
Why did Tex move back here?
Tex just ran plumb out of anything to do. I don't think he would mind me telling you what I know about this.
Well, I can turn it off.
Turn it off and then see what. Tex was down there, and I happened to be standing there talking to him when Bill walked up. And neither one of them said a word. They just hugged each other.
It would be touching.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's reminisce a little bit. You were talking about a play party. What is a play party?
Play party was a get-together that we had without music. We didn't have too many play parties because we always had a musician in the family. But you could do usually dances like Virginia Reel and various Ocean Wave and various of the old dances just by cadence rather than with music. So if you didn't have music to play, you called them play parties. But you play all sorts of games, but usually there was dancing involved. You used to play the old game we used to call Going to California and what would you take and who would you go with and all this. The boys and girls get together. Usually get, you know, for take his best girl, and then what would you do? And it'd get plumb risque sometimes. Somebody would say the wrong thing. Then we had candy pullings. They'd sorghum molasses candy, usually fudge, and just any excuse to get together.
Was there music at those kinds of things?
Well, around us, it nearly always turned into music, but it wasn't necessary.
Mm-hmm. Did he influence your music any, you think, as far as being in the community?
Well, I never saw him very many times because he lived a good 10 miles away and he had to go on a mule because there wasn't any road across there. But, yeah, he did influence my music. The bass was the first instrument, really, that I, well, not exactly. I started playing mandolin and some guitar before that. But I stuck with the bass for several years. And I was impressed because of what the bass did for the band. We had the band. Occasionally somebody would have a piano. If we went to somebody's house, had a piano. And piano is good fiddle rhythm, and it's also old time. It's not used very much anymore because people think it's a pop instrument, but it wasn't. It was used as a courting instrument. And my brother Reedy has made a living at it for 30 years. Playing backhanded chords on the piano. But the bass added so much to the music that I was impressed. And the first opportunity I got, I learned to pick a little bass. I never did learn much, but I still play the bass.
Mandolin's my favorite.
I do a little of that too.
You'll have to play a little bit for me.
No, you're studying bluegrass. I don't play bluegrass. I love it, but I don't play.
Well, I can listen. Don't give me a hard time about it.
But everybody that I heard influenced my music in some way. There were the one fiddler that I remember that was a good friend that would play, but they didn't get him to play for dance as much because he cut corners. What I mean by cutting corners is he'd break meter. He did not wait long enough. You know, he didn't, like you would count if you read music. But you have to have that automatic counter in your mind. And But he had some tunes that I never knew of anybody else playing, and a couple of them I still play. His son and I play together some, and we still play a couple of those old tunes that his daddy played. And so everybody influences you to some extent, good, bad, or indifferent. And I'm a very sorry musician. I talk about it a whole lot better than I play it.
Oh, I have it hard to believe. Do you think, we always think about the blues element in this music coming in through black, but do you think there was a white element of blues that you really didn't have to have the black influence?
You know, that I can't answer because there were not any black people other than this, just one or two that we knew. The only black person I heard play until I was grown was this old fella on the bass.
Black.
And so I don't really know. Blues is a wide category. I'm not sure that black people have an inherent rhythm that I'd give anything for. I don't know that you're born with it, but most black musicians, no matter what type music they're doing, there's some of what I think we're calling blues in it. The rhythm. Bill has bluegrass rhythm, which is much faster than blues rhythm, but the rhythm is there. It's on time. And blues is a feeling. And so I'm not sure where all of it come from. That I don't know that you learn that. I think you either have it or you don't. And so with that in mind, I can't really say that our music today was all blues was influenced by blacks, because people, white people are born some with the rhythm, some without it. I'm sure there are black people that are born without it too. But I love black gospel and black jazz and black blues, because not so much that I appreciate that kind of music, but the rhythm that's in the background, the feeling that you get. And I don't know, I'm not convinced that you can learn that.
Did you know anything about Arnold Schultz?
I know who Arnold was. Tex told me a lot about Arnold. I'm going to have to go here before
10.
Well, yes. We can find a convenient time. Or I might possibly be in Owensboro sometime before too long.
Okay.
I appreciate your interest.
It would be wonderful to know what Tex told you about Arnold.
Well, I don't know. I've got somewhere, and I'll have to hunt it up. But there was somebody before Arnold that came up with that style of picking. Now Rager picked a lot of his up from Schultz. I don't know, I'll have to find that, what that was, but I wrote it down because Tex gave credit to some guitar player before he ever heard Arnold, or, and he knew both, he knew Arnold and Mose Rager, but, and then of course Merle Travis learned from both of them, but there's another name involved that Tex gave me, and I wrote it down because I thought it might need some time, and I don't know, I'll have to find where it is.
Let's plan on when it's convenient.
I tell you what, give me your, since we've fiddled around here till almost time my appointment, let me have your address.
Okay.
And
I've,
phone
I've
number.
Got a, I've got a card, why don't I give it to you when I get out?
Okay, now what I'll do is Xerox a bunch of these articles for you,
okay.
And then I'll just put them in the mail.
Okay.
And that'd be easier, I think. That's cool. I don't know right offhand where we'd go to find somebody that's open that would have one.
Well, I have a Xerox machine.
Oh, do you?
So if you were an Owensboro.
Well, I'd bring my book by and you can just run off what you want.
And I need to get you to sign this before I leave. Wouldn't that be awful to do this interview and not have my donor form signed? This just states that this is for the Oral History Commission, and if you want a copy of the interview, I'll make sure you have one at the closing of the project. Have a year to complete it.
Well, you can date it, or you want me to date it?
If we get into something and you
want to
restrict it, we can later. But we can always turn it off.
No, we've talked. I'm worse than Tex. Tex would ramble. You had to just listen for some, soon be 20 years, I guess. I've known him off and on and dealt with him as, you know, on business deals and what have you. I talked to him a number of times. And I have never gotten the feeling or the impression about Bill that some folks down to Rosine or roundabout seem to have. He's always been the perfect gentleman. He calls me Mister, which embarrasses me. And James is the same way. He's just a gentleman of the first order in politeness. And of course, we were taught that. We were smacked on the head if we didn't when we had company when we were little. And Bill has kept that. Now, he's not an outgoing person. He got a keen sense of humor, but it's awfully hard to get him to grin. You have to watch his eyes. But he'll be aggravating you to death, and if you look at his eyes, he's enjoying every minute of it.
Yeah, I've noticed that about Bartha. See, to me, Bartha and Bill seem to be a lot alike.
You can see the humor in his eyes if you look when he might be just cutting you down with what he's saying, but in the background. And he's been extremely nice to me, and I'm just proud to count he and James among my friends.
Well, what I'd like to do the next time we're together is get you to, you know, how you were taking the scrapbook and reminiscing about all that. And I'd like you to do that on the tape.